You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 9th to the 15th of June 2016. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by acting features editor Paul Jump, reporter Chris Havergal, and books editor Karen Shook. For the first time ever, the proportion of undergraduates in England saying that their degree was poor value for money has exceeded the proportion who said it was good value, with more than a third saying that their studies had been either poor or very poor value. Meanwhile, students from ethnic minorities are significantly less likely to be satisfied with their university experience, according to the same survey, which is the HEPI HEA Student Academic Experience Survey. Chris will fill us in just a moment. On June the 23rd, the UK goes to the polls in the EU referendum. You may have heard about it. Our cover feature this week sees seven scholars assess the arguments for leaving the union, and they pull no punches in the process. Paul will have that story shortly. And this week's book section features, among other things, bees, brutalism, buying things and betterment, along with the latest offerings from new and noteworthy writers. Karen will close the podcast with a roundup. But first, Chris, your splash lead news story this week looks at the HEPI HEA survey, and there's some quite interesting findings.
Yes, it's certainly one of the most sort of significant surveys on UK higher education's calendar, drawing on the responses of more than 15,000 students. And one of the key points this year, very topically, given that the government is considering increasing the tuition fee cap, is the finding that the proportion of English undergraduates, as you say, feeling that their degree was poor or very poor value for money, exceeded the proportion who thought it was good or very good for the first time. Not just English students, though, across the UK, even students who aren't paying £9,000 fees, the proportion of students saying their degree was good value is on the decline. And the survey pulls out some sort of interesting ideas about why this might be the case. I mean, of course, in England and other parts of the UK, there's sort of an increasing sort of consumer mindset among students and clearly dissatisfaction with fee levels. But perhaps two areas which particularly interested me were contact hours and delays in marking assignments by lecturers. There appears to be a strong link between levels of perceptions of value for money and the amount of contact hours that you had. It found that only around half of students who had nine or fewer contact hours were satisfied with their contact hours. The numbers for students who had between 10 and 30 contact hours were much higher. And also, as I said about marking, it found that students' expectations of how long it should take to mark an assignment were met in only around half of cases. 43% of students said it would be reasonable to receive assignments back in a fortnight. This only happened in 22% of cases. A quarter of students said it took up to 4 weeks to get their work back. So with a teaching excellence framework on the horizon, clearly some significant challenges here for universities to deal with.
It's about making students feel special, really, isn't it? It's no surprise that if you show up at university, regardless of what you're paying, I think some courses have 5, 6, 7, 8 hours contact time a week, and then it's sort of go away, read the books, come back, and we'll have a chat about it.
Interestingly, though, the authors of the report, which, as we say, is produced by the Higher Education Policy Institute and the Higher Education Academy, don't just fall back on the sort of defence of saying, which is so often used, of saying, oh, well, you know, contact hours, I don't equate with teaching quality. You know, that's not what we should measure things on. You know, they say, well, this is all fair enough, that students really do care about contact hours. This isn't going to go away. And it, basically, the report says there's two options for universities here. Either they need to sort of dedicate greater effort to explaining why contact hours are reasonable for particular courses and perhaps sort of supporting students to work independently more, or in some cases they may need to just look at increasing contact hours.
Yeah, certainly something that will be of interest to universities as the TEF approaches too. And now elsewhere in that report, Chris, something else you focus on in this week's magazine, it found that students from ethnic minorities are significantly less likely to be satisfied with their university experience.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time that the HEPHEA survey has broken down satisfaction by ethnicity. It's already well known that students from black and ethnic minority backgrounds do less well at university in terms of the grades that they get. And this shows for the first time that they're also, and perhaps the two are linked, but it shows they're also less satisfied. 27% is the average score of average proportion of students who said they were very satisfied. When you look at students of Chinese ethnicity, it's as low as 16%, and for students from an Asian background, it's 17%. As I say, there may well be a link between attainment and satisfaction. If students feel that they're underperforming, that may be reflected in their level of satisfaction. But the study does sort of, again, pull out some interesting strands of what might be behind this. And finds particularly in the case of Asian students, they are disproportionately likely to live at home, significantly more so than other ethnic groups. And there appears to be a link between living at home and not feeling supported by your university or indeed by your peers to be an independent student. And there appears to be a strong link between those factors and lower satisfaction. So again, the TEF is going to be broken down by ethnicity and university's performance for different ethnic groups. So plenty here to keep universities busy again.
That story you will also find, of course, on our website at timeshighereducation.com, and it's the lead news story in the magazine as well. Moving on to our features section, Paul, the cover feature this week, perhaps unsurprisingly, is all about the EU referendum, which is just around the corner.
Yeah, we did debate whether people could take any more of this after a lot of heart searching. We concluded that they might just about be able to, provided that the people that contribute to the debate are sort of drawing on some level of expertise rather than plucking numbers from the sky. Mm. So yes, we've got seven people who all sort of don't necessarily express a view on whether we should stay in or out, but just make sort of interesting points based on their own expertise. It's not very difficult to work out where Danny Dorning stands on it. Makes the case that the UK is the least progressive country in Europe, and it's hardly the EU that's holding it back from being more progressive. But some of the other pieces are a bit less sort of obvious where they stand. Sue Onslow from School of Advanced Study, for example, just talks about the history of conservative Euroscepticism and makes the point that it didn't begin with Geoffrey Howe's resignation speech in the early 90s. It actually goes back a long way, and there's been previous sort of talk by sort of anti-European conservatives about, we ought to focus more on trading with the Commonwealth, etc., etc. And that idea was apparently discredited in the 1950s, but somehow it's reared its head again. Another one, Oliver Morrissey from Nottingham, points out that even if Britain left the EU and renegotiated sort of trade agreements, bilateral trade agreements in its own right, all of these trade agreements would have to abide by World Trade Organization rules, and in fact these are the things to which a lot of the Brexit supporters object. But there's ultimately there's no escape from those. You can't have a trade deal without there being rules about what you can and can't do, and those rules are fairly universal. So evidently Brexit wouldn't get us out of those. The other thing I guess worth saying, it's probably already obvious from what I've said, but we didn't ask people to confine themselves to discussing about the effects of Brexit on HE. We thought that probably really would try people's patience. The only person who really talks about that is Michael Liversedge, your former dean at Bristol, who is very scathing of UUK's case for remaining in the EU. He thinks it doesn't hold water.
It's an interesting read. Once you've read the feature, you can still have your say. We're running a Brexit poll. We want anyone who is eligible to vote in the referendum and who works in UK higher education to let us know what they think about the whole debate. If you head over to timeshighereducation.com, you'll find a link to the survey in the middle of the homepage. At least you will if you go there before the 9th of June. Because that was when we will start collating those results and we'll be publishing those next week. But that features in the magazine, also on the website, and it lies just before our weekly book section. Karen, what have we got this week?
This week's new and noteworthy section leads off with a book by Susan Bloom called I Love Learning, I Hate School, An Anthropology of College. Makes me think of the fact that when I moved here from Canada all those years ago, I didn't realise that you couldn't say school when you were talking about still being at university, and the shocked looks I got from people when I asked them about their studies, the offended looks. I've never forgotten it. Anyway, school in this case is talking about higher education, and Bloom has done an ethnographic study of undergraduates based on peer-to-peer interviews about why students are so focused on instrumentalism, trying to get the highest marks with the least effort, and what it is about the system that causes them to do so. So she,
human nature.
Indeed. But of course, she says that there are structural problems with higher education. A lot of the examples she uses would be familiar to people in the UK system. And she concludes by saying, I love the students, I deplore the system. It's got quite a lot of first-hand accounts from students, and it's definitely worth a read. Also, in New and Noteworthy, Eric Hobsbawm, before he died, asked that a collection of his work on Latin America be published. It has been. It's a very big book. Covers everything from Castro to Colombia. Also this week, the Nobel Prize-winning biologist Carl von Frisch, who discovered the waggle dance of bees, and also discovered how hard it was to be a scientist during the Nazi era, is written about in Tanya Munce's book, The Dancing Bees and the Discovery of the Honeybee Language. Also this week, Anne-Marie Adams covers Barnabas Calder's book, Raw Concrete, The Beauty of Brutalism. It's a fantastic book. For those of you who are perhaps skeptic about the virtues of brutalism, you need to read this book. He talks about the University of Leicester's famous engineering building designed by James Stirling and James Gowan as a sneering, hip-thrusting Elvis of a structure. And, you know, if you look at it, you can start to see it's a little Elvis-like.
I quite like brutalism. I always have. I don't know why. I think, around here where we are, you've got the Brunswick Centre around the corner, Barbican.
No shortage of glorious concrete.
I find them quite imposing. Yeah, I really quite like them.
Anyone who's read Malcolm Gladwell knows that he's talked about the 10,000 hour rule, not how long it takes to get down the tube platform at rush hour, but how long it takes to become an expert in anything. And it draws on work by Anders Ericsson, a psychologist, who has pointed out that the 10,000 hour rule is a gross oversimplification. But of course, there's something about those snappy lines of gross oversimplification that makes them a lot easier to remember. So here, Philip Roscoe reviews Anders Ericsson and Robert Poole's book, Peak, Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. What we're being dangled in front of us is how to become an expert in something. Inevitably, the book says, I think you'll find it's not as simple as that. This week's book of the week is by Elizabeth Chin, My Life with Things, The Consumer Diaries. Chin is an anthropologist based in Pasadena at the Art Center College of Design. She decided to look at stuff and why we like stuff, how we're attached to consumption, what it is about stuff that we love. And there's a very personal thread to the review. She talks about trainers she's bought that are fantastic, but it's not as fluffy as all that. And she's very good at looking at teasing out the connections between, for example, consumerism and the history of slavery in the United States. She quotes Jamaica Kincaid on Black Americans' relationship to consumerism and why it's different to, say, white Americans, which is because in the past we were capital, like bales of cotton and sacks of sugar. She includes her diaries in this book, although she points out to me in the author profile that their diaries, not, you know, ripped from her 13-year-old desk drawer, but written as a kind of field notes, looking at her relationship to various things. Shahida Bari's our reviewer this week.
Thanks, Karen. Yes, you'll find that book of the week and the book section begins on page 46 of the magazine. And of course, all of that is online too on our website. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you wish to comment on anything we've discussed or indeed anything else in the magazine, you can do so. Just head over to that site. You'll also find us on Twitter, on Facebook and on LinkedIn as well. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.